Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing fine, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. We have announcements, events, things coming up. We want to get past those really quick.
Friday, January 26th in the evening, Justin and I will be doing a live show at Panic Fest in Kansas City, Missouri. So if you're in the area or can get to it, you might want to check it out. On March 24th in Los Angeles, we will be at Idle Hour from 3 to 7 p.m. Come out and meet us.
Panic Fest is happening. Screenland on Armor. Tonight's case is a doozy. When you threw this on the schedule, I immediately ran out to Thinking Sideways site to listen to their episode on it. And lo and behold, they haven't covered this. I was very surprised.
This seems like exactly the kind of case that is made for Thinking Sideways.
I know. So, not saying you need to run out and do it, but I would love to hear your guys' take on this. What are we covering tonight, Aaron?
Tonight is the case of the Circleville letter writer.
This was 1976, the year of my birth. In a quiet town of Circleville, Ohio, weird letters began arriving to many of the area residents. And these letters had very intimate details of the recipient's life, and often were of a threatening or derogatory nature. One of the recipients was a woman named Mary Gillespie, who was accused of having an affair with the school's superintendent. She was a bus driver, and she claimed that she wasn't having one. But over the next 25 years, these letters would continue and result in a suspicious death, an attempted murder, possible wrongful conviction and imprisonment, and an enduring question of who is the real Circleville letter writer.
As Justin said, this is a doozy of a case because it has a lot of interesting characters, and there are a lot of questions surrounding this case in terms of what are the motivations of this letter writer and who could be behind such a long-running mission to harass and threaten people, including those at the center of this case, which I would consider to be Mary Gillespie and her husband, Ron.
If you simply go down all the rabbit holes of the letters, who received them, what their messages were, everyone's a suspect. But I think if you focus on the hard evidence and ideas that played out, I don't know if there's as much of a mystery, but it's still crazy.
Mary Gillespie was a school bus driver, and she received her first letter in 1976. Mary Gillespie was accused of having an affair with the superintendent of schools, Gordon Massey.
But she was married and didn't reveal these letters to her husband or anyone at first.
It was easy just to hide the letters because she felt like they were being sent to her. And even though the letter writer was threatening her, she felt, I guess at the time, that the only thing to do was to hide the letters. Maybe if she hides them, the person will lose interest and they'll go away.
But she receives two letters, so they're not going away. And then her husband will end up receiving a letter. And of course, in his letter, it said, your wife is having an affair with the superintendent. You have to make this stop. Otherwise, violent threats against you. Which is kind of weird to threaten the man who's kind of a victim in this situation, but the letter writer isn't always coherent and they don't make a lot of sense.
Well, and again, we don't know what their motivation is. Obviously, there's something about this affair that has them riled up. My first thought is they're upset because perhaps they're jealous of Mary's affair. Maybe they wished she was having an affair with them. On the other hand, that doesn't make a lot of sense because it seems like they're angry that she's having an affair, period. So maybe they really don't like affairs.
I think it's somebody that is either affiliated or a family member or the spouse, something like that. Those are the people that are going to be lashing out. Because if they know that their spouse is having an affair, if they know that, or their parent is having an affair, they have the biggest dog in the race.
Now, these original letters were handwritten, and they're entirely in block letters. There's no way to tell who sent them, but they've been mailed from nearby Columbus, Ohio. The letters can be threatening and sometimes very derogatory. One of the letters stated to her that, I know where you live. I've been observing your house and know you have children. This is no joke. Please take it serious.
When I read some of the letters, I just want to fix all the grammar and spelling mistakes. It's sort of funny.
Now, because her husband received a letter, now the cat's kind of out of the bag, at least at her house. And I can't even imagine what their conversation was like after he read his letter. It doesn't seem like there is any information on this, is there?
Not really, just that they had an argument. They were discussing it. She was denying it. She showed the crazy letters that she received as a sort of a way to pacify him. Like, this is just some crazy. Don't worry about it. Whether Ron completely believed her and not the allegations against her, it's a little unclear.
Now, the fourth letter they received told Ron that if he didn't make her admit the truth of what was going on and inform the school board, then the letter writer would broadcast the truth on CBs, I guess meaning CB radios, posters, signs, and billboards until the truth comes out.
So this is pre-internet times. This is how you troll in real life and slander people without social media.
And what do trolls create, right? They create gossip and they create a lot of fear, a lot of discomfort too. According to Ron and Mary, there were only three people that knew about the letters. And those included Ron's sister, Karen, her husband, Paul Freshour, and Paul's sister. They were talking about this, and Mary stated that she thought she knew who was sending the letters. So the five of them got together and wrote up some letters and sent them to who Mary thought was writing the letters. Okay, so let's be clear on this. Mary, Ron, Ron's sister Karen, her husband, and her husband's sister all got together to try and put a stop to this by writing five letters, and Paul wrote these letters and then sent them to the writer that Mary thought was writing, that was sending out these letters, that Mary thought was sending out these letters. Now, what came out of this was apparently no more letters were received for about a few weeks. And according to Paul Freshour, he said, "We thought we'd scare the guy. We sent him 4 or 5 letters only. There was no violence in them or anything, just that we knew who he was and what he was doing, and we sent him the letters."
So he's inferring that it is a male that is doing this.
Now, in August of 1977, on August 19th, to be precise, Ron gets a threatening call at his house. And it upsets him so much that he heads out. Now, what do we know about this call, Justin? Was the caller letting him know that there was going to be a meeting where they could get this all settled?
We really don't know because of events that happened shortly thereafter, but we can assume that the caller, that Ron recognized the caller's voice or something they said, because he's running out, we assume, to confront this person. Whether they're going to meet somewhere or Ron just knows, hey, that's so-and-so and I know where he lives, I'm going after him. So Ron picks up a gun, goes out and jumps in his car, his truck, and takes off. Not too far down the road, he wrecks his truck and he kills himself in this accident.
This is not very far from his home. I'm also wondering if the caller let him know who they were. Now, you're right. If there's a good possibility, he just recognized the voice. So he hits this tree and he dies. When they investigate this accident or possible murder, they find that he had a blood alcohol level of 0.16.
Double the legal limit.
According to those that knew Ron, they said he was not a drinker.
He was still drunk.
Well, I'm wondering, though, everyone has their breaking point. If he and his wife are receiving letters and other people are receiving letters about a supposed affair that his wife is denying, maybe he's driven to drink.
And if he thinks he knows who this person is that's destroying his life, maybe he needs the liquid courage to go after them.
It's not real clear on how soon after the call he leaves his house with the gun. So maybe he drank some more. We just don't know. His children say that he didn't appear drunk. But I could imagine if someone's very determined looking, they may not be showing signs of drunkenness.
A lot of people point out that he wrecks his truck very close to home. And they assume that, oh, well, he knew this area. How could he wreck? But most accidents actually happen close to home because it's where you feel the most comfortable and aware, because you're like, oh, well, I already know all the streets and all the turns here. So you kind of go into autopilot. And if you're drunk, then you're probably in double autopilot now and you're not paying attention. But this theory or idea that he was murdered, like ran off the road or something to that effect, is because it's said that his gun has been fired once. Now, the investigators say it has a spent shell in it, therefore it's been fired. We don't know if he was shooting at somebody or if he had just discharged the firearm in anger, or even possibly, did he shoot this gun off earlier in the day? We're not that sure. The information about it's not that clear, but the investigator just says it had been fired once. So we go with that.
Furthermore, a private investigator named Martin Yant seems to indicate that it had been fired between the time that he left his house and crashed his truck.
I don't know if gunpowder residue detection was even a thing in 1977, and I'm not going to Google it, but they can smell a firearm and you can tell if it's been fired recently. So that's good enough evidence for me.
We have these letters arriving at the Gillespie household, probably causing some friction. And now it's resulted in the death of Ron Gillespie. So things are escalating here, right?
Yeah. This has gone from a stupid troll to somebody's dead. And it's because of these letters and these phone calls.
Now, immediately, Paul Freshour, who is married to Ron's sister, says that this is foul play. He firmly believes that this was a murder of some kind. And yet, the police, after their investigation, believe this is an accident.
I don't know. We've covered so many cases where people are drunk and wreck their vehicles. I guess that's the perfect murder, is run a drunk person off the road, because I'm going to assume that they ran themselves off the road. I guess that's how you get away with murder, because I'm never going to just flat out accept that this was foul play.
What's interesting about this is letters start to go out that indicate that Sheriff Dwight Radcliffe, the longtime sheriff of Pickaway County Sheriff's Department, is covering up this supposed murder of Ron Gillespie.
Okay, I get that law enforcement deems it an accident. So if you don't agree with that, then you would, of course, say that it's a cover-up. But when somebody with a blood alcohol content of 0.16 runs their truck off the road, I'm not that suspicious.
I'm sure you understand that if people hear that a man, even though he's been drinking, has rammed his truck into a tree, but that he has a spent shell in his revolver, that there must have been a crime here, right? I mean, why else would his gun be fired?
This is true. And the caller and the letter writers allegedly say, "We're watching you." So maybe they were waiting for him to leave his house to run him off the road. But how would they know that he would be drunk? How would they know that he would be driving fast and aggressively? There's so many factors here. I can't really buy into it.
It's after Ron's death that Mary Gillespie admits to having an affair with the superintendent, Gordon Massey. But they both insist that their affair didn't start until after the letters had been sent out.
So the letters brought them together for true love. Okay.
I don't know anybody who believes this. And so right off the bat, Mary seems to be untruthful here, doesn't she?
It's a little disingenuous. If I'm going to accept her at her word, I'm going to assume that her and the superintendent had eyes for each other, had some sort of interest for each other, but maybe possibly didn't pull the trigger until after the letters were written. But still, emotional cheating and whatever, it's all the same. They were doing something, and I feel she's being disingenuous.
Well, I think this is an important point, because we still don't know the motivation of the letter writer. But if it's the immorality of Mary Gillespie and Gordon Massey, then if she lies about the affair, even after admitting to it, then that would just cause the letter writer to continue, right? Because that's what happens.
Yeah.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Now we need to fast forward a little bit here because the next significant event happens when Mary is driving the bus. In February of 1983, signs started to appear along her route that were talking about her and about her daughter. On February 7th of that year, Mary got out of her bus and took a sign down. And there was a box and string attached to it. Well, she gathered it all up and she brought it onto the bus and continued on her route. But then after she got home, she looked into it and discovered that a pistol was placed in the box as some sort of booby trap so that when she took the sign down, it was supposed to pull the string and fire a bullet at her. But of course, it didn't work.
Yeah, it was a 25 caliber pistol and there was foam stuff holding it in place to, and its barrel was placed up against the side, which the sign was about, you know, chest to head height, supposed to shoot her.
She does end up calling the police, and the police check out this gun, and it appears that the serial number on it, which would identify possibly who the owner was, had been rubbed away or scratched away. And then they did some analysis and were able to get the actual serial number off the gun still. And this gun traced back to Paul Freshour, who is Ron Gillespie's sister's husband.
Dun, dun, dun.
So that's pretty close to home, right?
Yeah. I guess when I look at this, though, I think, why would Paul care about this affair?
Unless he liked Mary.
This is true. But the gun is traced back to Paul. Now, he claims that it was stolen and he hasn't known its whereabouts in a long time.
At this time, Paul had recently separated from Karen, Ron's sister. And he said he had no idea what had happened to the gun because it had been kept in the garage. He hadn't had any use of it, so he didn't know what happened. He said it must have been stolen.
Yeah, lock your guns up, people.
Now, later that month, on February 25th of 1983, Paul was brought into the sheriff's office and he was asked for handwriting samples. From what I understand, when you do handwriting samples, you might tell someone what to write. But in this case, he wasn't just told what to write. He was actually shown envelopes and letters from the letter writer and was told to copy those. So write just like that and let's see how it comes out. I don't know. It just doesn't seem proper, does it, Justin?
No, I mean, it's block writing. Anyone can emulate block writing for the most part. You're not getting anything out of this unless you spell Beverly wrong. Like, anyways, but just looking at block writing and print, who knows? Everyone and anyone could probably emulate it very well. But this was enough for law enforcement to say, wow, what you've written looks very much like the letter writer's handwriting, and they move forward with that.
This is preposterous to me. I mean, they're literally saying, write like this, and then when he writes like that, it looks just like the letter writer's writing. Of course it does. That's what they told him to do. Now, Paul doesn't seem to be fazed by this because he's thinking, well, I didn't write these letters, so this will actually exonerate me. But that's not what happens. They're looking at him like, you're the letter writer. They search his garage where his gun had been kept, supposedly, and they gather up whatever evidence they can find. Now, they don't find anything that would tell them that he built this booby trap, but they do know that that was his gun. And according to the sheriff, even if he didn't write the letters, that was his gun in the booby trap. So they take him to trial on October 24th, 1983.
And I get this. He should be the prime suspect. The only physical evidence they have is a gun that ties back to him. Now, the day that she finds this weapon, they call his work. They talk to his boss. And his boss says he had the day off. So now Paul's looking even more suspicious. And I understand why he is the prime suspect. And I even understand why an indictment would be passed. But Paul has a lot of friends and people he's talked to the day of this booby trap incident, and he's got a pretty good alibi.
He at least has people who place him at home, certainly not over where this booby trap was set. This trial, though, is for the attempted murder of Mary Gillespie, because even though the booby trap wasn't very well set up, very well constructed, didn't seem like it would actually work, it's still the intent. Whoever set that up intended to hurt or murder somebody. Hence, Paul ends up at trial. Here's something that really starts this trial off badly, at least for me, is that they introduce 39 letters that were written between March 21st, 1977 and December 23rd, 1982. 39 letters from the letter writer, and they're attributing them to Paul. They're just saying, hey, this is evidence that he had it out for Mary, so check out these letters. And this was all okayed by Judge Ammer to be admissible. Paul did not take the stand in his own defense because, according to his lawyer, DePascal, if he chose to take the stand in his own defense, the judge was going to make over 1,000 letters admissible in trial.
So that's so weird. Like, if you take the stand, then I'm going to let all this other evidence in. But if you don't take the stand, I mean, this is all the legal melee that happens in trial that I have big problems with. The letters alone that they've already released saying these are from Paul, it really makes Paul look like a psychotic stalker. But again, there's no real tie to Paul and the letters. The only tie in here is the gun that was found belonged to him.
But the letters are used to set up that this is Paul, that it's all his doing. But again, all you have are supposed experts who are saying, yeah, he probably wrote the letters, but is that really enough? One of the witnesses at trial, Charles Spencer, stated that he helped Paul look for his missing gun prior to the day it was discovered as part of a booby trap. I find this interesting because apparently someone else knew it was missing, and Paul had actually asked for help. Now, this could be an alibi, right? He's trying to set up an alibi like, oh, hey, help me look for this gun. It's somehow missing. But yet maybe he had it somewhere else and he was going to set this booby trap up. And now he's got a witness that says, yeah, he totally lost that gun because I helped him look for it. A coworker of Paul's at Anheuser-Busch, where he was a supervisor, testified that he sold that particular gun, the 25 caliber gun, to Paul Freshour. So they can actually trace that. I didn't see where and when this happened, but this was introduced at trial showing that he did purchase a gun. I just don't know how long before the actual incident it was purchased.
Yeah, and Paul doesn't deny that the gun, you know, belonged to him. He fully admits that it was his firearm.
We don't know what would have happened had he taken the stand. You always have that chance that if someone's on the stand and they're passionate, that maybe they'll get through to them. It could be a powerful moment, but then you're also opening yourself up to the prosecution coming after you and cross-examining you. At the end of trial, which is just over the course of 4 days, I mean, we're talking from October 24th to October 28th of 1983. That's how long the trial lasts. 4 days. He is found guilty of the attempted murder of Mary Gillespie, and he's sentenced to 7 to 25 years in prison. As I said, the sheriff was asked about this, and he said, hey, even if Paul didn't write those letters, that was his gun that was used in that booby trap. And you kind of understand that. The gun was kept in his garage. Who would have even known about it? You have the guy that sold him the gun. You have his wife that probably knew about it, but who else? I mean, how many people knew about this gun being in that garage?
And how many people know about his gun and know about close members of his family and what they're doing on their off hours?
A private investigator looked into witnesses and was trying to track down more information about this gun. And there was a woman named Connie Mangus who gave a statement to this private investigator that she saw a man with Paul Freshour's gun the day before it was used in the trap. Now, I have a lot of questions about this because I don't know how Connie relates to Paul, but how does she know that that gun was Paul's? So when I asked earlier how many people knew about this gun, well, apparently word got out. So that kind of opens this up to maybe a lot of people knew about it and anybody could have gone into the garage to get this gun to be used in this trap. A Lieutenant Brown had spoken with Connie Mangus and he said that she never mentioned seeing Freshour's gun at all. So this is, I guess, in dispute, but it brings up this question of if the gun serial number was attempted to be obscured so that it couldn't be traced, was that on purpose so that Freshour could get away with this? Like maybe Paul is behind it? Or did someone scratch it or rub it away enough to where they knew it could be traced back to him so that he looks twice as guilty?
Or were they not wanting him to be tied to this and really just trying to make this an anonymous attempted murder?
Right. If they knew they could get into the garage and get the gun, well, now it's just convenient.
Yeah.
But again, every aspect of this case has multiple angles, and there are just so many questions with every one of these points.
So Paul is found guilty, and he's shipped off to prison. All is well. Everyone's happy. This psycho who's been writing these crazy letters and attempted to kill Mary is now behind bars. And the letters stop, right?
He's in Lima, Ohio, but the letters continued. And they're still postmarked from Columbus, Ohio, which is about 90 miles away or more. You have the sheriff who is visiting the prison and saying, hey, we still have these letters coming, so you need to do something about Paul Freshour. Because even in prison, he's getting these letters out. And I'm tired of it. This sheriff is serious business because he has a long tenure as sheriff. I mean, he's unopposable, right? He is the man. And he's going to the warden and saying, put a stop to this now. So the warden is curious too. And he does his own investigations into this to see if Paul could be sending the letters. They intercept everything coming to and from the prison. And they even put him in solitary confinement at times to hopefully stop the letters, but they keep coming.
So solitary confinement, if you don't know, is usually used as a punishment, and it's no joke. It can drive people to insanity, and they're throwing him in solitary where he has no access to the outside world, but the letters are still going. Now, if he's actually writing these letters, he's having to hide them in other letters and send them to somebody who is then driving to Columbus to mail them out. Or he's telling somebody to write the letter. So now he has to be in cahoots with another person. But regardless, I don't believe he is the letter writer at all at this point, because he would have to be telling somebody else to write the letters, because there's no way he can do this from prison.
The warden did his own investigating. He did his own tests. He monitored Paul, even put him in solitary confinement. But in the end, he doesn't think Paul had anything to do with these letters either. But that doesn't stop the sheriff. The sheriff continues to believe that Paul Freshour is the letter writer.
Paul is up for parole in December of 1990. This is 7 years sitting in prison and being thrown in solitary confinement and being blamed for these letters. His parole is denied because the parole board says, you've continued writing these hateful letters and you show no remorse for this crime. So they tell him, you're not getting out of prison.
Just days after that hearing, Paul himself received a letter from the letter writer that said, now, when are you going to believe you aren't going to get out of there? I told you 2 years ago, when we set them up, they stay set up.
This is unbelievable to me. And I hate to say it, but it gives me a severe lack of respect for this parole board, because they're not doing any investigation. All they're doing is going with what they're told. Oh, this guy's still writing letters, even though it is absolutely physically impossible for him to do it. And the warden says he's not doing it. Doesn't matter to the parole board. They make him sit in prison for many more years.
When you add in the fact that these letters aren't helping his case at all, it's hurting him, it makes no sense for him to be the letter writer at this point.
No. And when he's receiving letters, I guess that could be the, you know, diabolical plan. I received a letter, so I'm not the letter writer, but the wording, everything about it, if he was the letter writer, he isn't now.
I mentioned Martin Yant before, the investigative reporter. He was continuing to look into the attempted murder of Mary Gillespie and the letter writer case, and he found some additional evidence that never came up at trial. Another bus driver who drove by where the booby trap was about 20 minutes before Mary did saw a distinctive yellow El Camino parked there with a tall man with sandy hair standing next to it. Now, when she was driving by, he turned away from the bus so that she wouldn't see his face. The person's description does not fit Paul Freshour at all, but it does fit someone else. And this person was Karen Freshour's new boyfriend.
So Paul's estranged wife's new boyfriend drives an El Camino, has blonde hair. That would be called exculpatory evidence that was not brought up in trial?
Yeah, it could be exculpatory because it sure as hell sounds like someone close to this case may have been involved because they were at that scene.
Hmm.
But it really wasn't investigated. So it's, I guess, further evidence that maybe his trial wasn't so fair.
And maybe this man shouldn't have been sitting in prison.
In March of 1992, Grove City, which is about 26 miles from Circleville and much closer to Columbus, Police Chief James R. McKeon received an anonymous letter. It was very similar to these other Circleville letters, except that these were printed in all small or lowercase letters rather than capital letters. And in it, the writer identified the original letter writer as Mary. They said it was a teacher named Mary. Now, remember, Mary Gillespie was a bus driver, but it almost sounds like they're inferring that it was her, that she was writing the letters. And if you recall, back then, the letter writer was accusing her and Gordon Massey of an affair. And then at some point, her husband died in his truck after he hit a tree. So maybe she got what she wanted. Maybe she wanted this affair to turn into a real relationship. And then her husband's out of the way, right? That's almost what this sounds like. Anyway, they added that the same person who killed Ron Gillespie in 1977 was also responsible for killing a Pickaway County school teacher by the name of Vicky Koch just 3 years later. Now, that Koch murder had never been solved. But sometime later, Chief McKeon got a second letter, and the writer went on about how Mary printed her letters and had set up numerous booby traps at the schools that had never been discovered. So the police, I guess, took this very seriously and did some investigating, but they never found any evidence of another booby trap at any school in the area.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
So now we have two murders, or alleged murders, but I don't know how Koch gets thrown into this besides this letter that's saying, hey, they're responsible for both. And this is written in lower print. Now, these letters are kind of a big deal because of the whole trial against Paul. So are other people seeing the power of the pen or the pencil and using it for their own motivations?
This woman who was murdered, Vicky Koch, she was supposedly having an affair as well. We could go down that rabbit hole and everything, but just the important part here is that she was also having an affair, and then she ended up murdered. And I would say this is a new letter writer personally, because it's written completely different, but it still has that same message that there's this affair going on. Now they're indicating that this person was murdered by the same person who killed Ron Gillespie. So there's a supposed tie in there.
Paul will get paroled in May of 94, which is 10 years after being incarcerated. He will maintain his innocence and believes the actual letter writer is still at large. The TV show Unsolved Mysteries, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with it, ran a section on this in November of 94. And Mary and the sheriff didn't agree to be on the show. But shortly thereafter, a postcard was sent to the office and the people, the PR people at Unsolved Mysteries. And it said, Forget Circleville, Ohio. If you come to Ohio, UL sickos will pay. Now, this is a month after the TV show aired. So if the letter writer wanted to make an impact, they would have more or less wanted to tell them not to come there and film this show and air this episode. El sickos, the wording in here is different than the other letters. Personally, I don't believe that this letter that was sent to Unsolved Mysteries was the letter writer. I think it was just some other idiot, you know, moron troll that wants to write a letter and not get any fame for it. I don't, whatever.
This letter, and I read this letter, this postcard, and to me, the letters look very much like this postcard. Again, it could easily be copied, I suppose, but it's very, very similar, if not the same. The one thing that stood out to me, though, was El Sickos. And if you remember, there was an El Camino scene at the scene. And I wonder if, and maybe this is just reaching, but El Sickos, El Camino, I don't know. For some reason, it really just popped out at me.
Paul is now out of prison. He maintains his innocence. He puts up a website and writes 120-something page. I won't call it a manifesto because that's sort of derogatory, but this 120-something page just research paper. Now, it's not that coherent, but it has a lot of the court documents and evidence and his own thoughts on things. Oddly enough, in the beginning, he seems somewhat sympathetic or agreeable to the letter writer, which that just makes you think, well, maybe he was the guy because he's agreeing with it. But I don't know why he would agree with the letter writer that got him put in prison. I don't know. It's one of those things where you can take that a lot of different ways. But he puts out a lot of this information, and really it doesn't answer a lot of questions. It doesn't have a lot of answers. It just puts forth more questions. But sadly, Paul will pass away in 2012.
So that's pretty much where the story dies, because sometime in the 1990s, whether it's in the mid-90s or in the late 90s, the letter writer stops. Or letter writers stop. Either way you want to look at it. But why did they stop?
Well, if you think it was Paul, then hey, he's on his last leg, he's about to pass away, and now the letters are gone, so they stop. If you think that it's somebody else, well, the affair is no longer on their spectrum. And when you think about the original letters of, hey, this is a cover-up by this sheriff, and then you look at the letter that was sent to Unsolved Mysteries, forget Circleville, Ohio, pretty much they say the sheriff had nothing to do with this. So now the letter writer is contradicting themselves, or is it multiple letter writers? And that's, I guess our first question is it one person or is it multiple people? And if it's multiple people, are they in cahoots or are they all doing this separately with their own agendas?
Right. So you have a myriad of suspects here. Mary herself as a suspect. You could say that she set everything up so that her affair was outed, but then she got her husband out of the way, right? And then you have the superintendent's wife and son, Gordon Massey's family, who may have done this to try and get him to stop the affair.
That definitely is a motive for them.
And then you have Paul Freshour, who some say could have totally done this because it was his gun used in the booby trap. Maybe he was upset with the affair. And after his incarceration, he had someone else who knew what to write and was continuing to send out letters. And because he couldn't get out word to them to stop doing it because it was actually hurting him while he was in prison, they continued. So that's another theory, is that Paul Freshour was behind it. And if you ask the sheriff seemed to fully believe that Paul Freshour was the letter writer. But beyond all this, you have a suspect who was also a bus driver, and his name was David Longberry. And supposedly, he was very interested in Mary. And so his motive would be jealousy. he was hoping to get Mary to stop seeing the superintendent, because obviously if she's doing that, then maybe she's not so into her husband. Maybe this is his way of getting in there with Mary, right?
In his own twisted imagination, sure.
But at some point, this bus driver, David Longberry, was living with an elderly couple, and they had their granddaughter over. And this was on July 11th, 1999. So remember, the letters, they stopped sometime in the mid to late 90s. And while he was there, he raped this girl in the living room while everyone was home, meaning the older couple, the grandparents of this girl. The grandfather confronted him after hearing from his granddaughter, and David Longberry fled immediately. He didn't take anything with him. He literally went out the door, and no one saw him again. So he's wanted, but no one knows where he is. But it turns out, and this is after a number of years, that down in El Paso, Texas, a truck driver had dropped him off at a truck stop, and he hanged himself behind that truck stop. That news never reached back where he was wanted for this crime, for this rape.
So David's tie-in is he was a fellow bus driver who allegedly had an interest in Mary. The letters stop at about the same time that this incident happens with him, but it's still a loose connection here.
So Justin, thinking about all of the possible motivations or the reasons why there might be multiple letter writers, do we have any more information we can give to people? Like, what are our thoughts on this? What do we really think happened here?
Well, let's just go through the suspects. Gordon's family, they wanted him to stop having the affair, so possibly they could have written the letters. This David Longberry guy had an interest in Mary, so he possibly could have written the letters. But when I look at this case and I have to cut all the fat away and just pull my head out of all the rabbit holes, we have a 25 caliber gun that was in Paul's garage, and we have an El Camino that was seen at the site of the booby trap. And Karen, Paul's estranged wife, is the only connection here to the physical direct evidence of any of this, at least to the attempted murder.
And the question would be, what would be her motivation to hurt Mary? Then again, what if this was just all set up to frame her husband so that he would take the hit? Because my understanding is when they were going through their divorce, that he was getting everything. She was really losing out on this divorce. And then after he went to prison, well, she inherited everything because he was out of the picture now.
He was going to get the kids. He was going to get the house. He was getting everything. Now, another little aside to this is Mary is getting these letters and it's screwing up her relationship with her husband. Her husband ends up dying in a car wreck. But this booby trap, this sign in the box, she ran up, took the sign down and grabbed the box and walked back to her bus with it. And then later pried the box open to find the gun. That's kind of suspicious, I guess. I think, why would you do that? But there are comments out there on the interwebs that say Mary was in on it. Mary wanted to leave her husband. Mary wanted to have this affair. So her and Karen were in cahoots. Now we have multiple letter writers. Now we have multiple agendas. But again, the more you read into it, the more this spiderwebs out. And it's crazy.
Yeah, it really seems like you could really focus on Karen in this, but only in a section of the history of the letter writer, because over time, things change. The motivations of the letter writer seems to change. And at one point, I was thinking, wait a minute, what if this just became a vehicle that anybody could jump into and take for a ride? In other words, I want this agenda to be advanced, so now I'm going to write letters.
That's what trolls do on the internet every day. It's just old school snail mail. And I thought possibly Paul might have been in cahoots here, but why wouldn't he come forward and say, oh yeah, by the way, that was my ex-wife and I, you know, that was us doing this. He lost in the divorce. He got thrown in prison. I would think that would be enough motivation for him to turn around and point the finger at somebody else, but he never does. And why wouldn't other people jump in and start writing letters when the letters are having an effect? Fight fire with fire. They even said they all got together and wrote letters to who they thought was the letter writer to get them to stop. So they're doing that. In the end, the letter writer got their way. They exposed people. They publicly shamed people. The terrorist won in this case.
This is one of those cases where I question everything. Even if you say, well, Mary might have been behind the letters, I don't know that you could say that she wanted her husband dead. Maybe she was just hoping he would get so mad he would leave her, right? I mean, after all, he was one who was drunk and then took off in his truck. So he put himself in danger.
Yeah.
I know you can push people's buttons, but I mean, who was to say that he would necessarily been drinking at that time? Unless if she was behind it, she could have let someone know, hey, this is the perfect time to piss him off.
Yeah. Could have been very much unintended, but it seems that she wanted him out of the picture.
But yeah, in the end, it does feel like there were probably multiple letter writers and at different times. Because for it to go on this long, what kind of an obsession is that? We know there are people that get obsessed, but to this point, and then their MO changes at some points, it just seems so weird. It's very much, like I said before, it feels like this became a vehicle and people started to use that vehicle to their own ends.
And when you look at the letters, the agendas change, some of the handwriting changes, and a couple of them were postmarked from Circleville and not from Columbus. So I truly think that at least a few of these letters were not from one origin.
So by all means, go out and read up on this case, read the letters, and see what you think. And if you have any thoughts on this, join our discussion group on Facebook and tell us all about it. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.